Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us today. Just want to remind you, during this time when we're home much more than typically because of COVID-19, that anytime you're around the house and you got a smart speaker, you can tell it to play KPECC, courteously, of course, because it's part of your household, right? Whether powered by Google or by Amazon, it works on all smart speakers. Just tell it to play KPECC. You've also got on your smartphone the KPECC app as well, and the multiple transmitters throughout Southern California, from Santa Barbara to the Coachella Valley, and throughout the Southland. A great chance for you to hear KPECC multiple ways. Did you see the story about the air quality over 4th of July weekend in Southern California? It was the worst air quality measured in any year in the last decade. That because of all the personal fireworks that people shot off, because the professional fireworks shows weren't being held, plus just personal fireworks seem to be becoming more and more popular here in Southern California every year. But just extraordinary high. It was either very unhealthy or hazardous in large parts of LA and Orange County overnight on the 4th of July and into the morning of July 5th. I looked out late on the night of the 4th from our house. I was looking at the streetlights, and it looked like there was a heavy fog just because of all that fireworks smoke that was hanging in the air. Takes back to the terrible air quality days of the 1960s here in Southern California. We are going to be talking a little bit later about a new LAist podcast, and we'll talk with the brand new host of that. Also joining us right now to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions that relate to President Trump's income tax returns, U.S. Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg Law, Kimberly Robinson. She also co-hosts Bloomberg Law's podcast, Cases and Controversies. Kimberly, good to have you with us.
Always happy to do it.
I appreciate it. So let's talk first about the decision that went against President Trump, and that is that the Manhattan District Attorney subpoenaing the president's tax returns does have a right to do so. Explain a bit the decision here and what the majority opinion says.
Well, the majority opinion is 7-2, but I think what is really interesting here is that the court unanimously rejected the president's really broad assertion that he has immunity from even being investigated for crimes while he's in office. So you may remember that his lawyer told an appellate court that the president could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and that the state could not investigate, nor the city could investigate the president while he's in office. Every single justice rejected that really broad immunity. But seven of the justices also rejected this idea that a state needed to show or a city needed to show some kind of heightened need for these cases when pursuing a grand jury subpoena. And that was really what the majority said.
So what is available to the president's legal team to try and avoid having to provide tax returns to the Manhattan grand jury?
Well, the court did leave open the possibility that when this case goes back down to the lower courts, that the president could assert really a too much burden from having to turn over these documents, that it would impede his duties as the president. But that's going to be something that's going to be very hard for him to prove, given that, you know, the Supreme Court made President Bill Clinton sit for a deposition while he was a sitting president. Here, all that's being asked is that Trump not impede a third party from actually turning over the documents. So it seems like a pretty uphill climb for them in the lower courts.
So if in the lower court, the president suffers a setback there as well because of the difficulty in crossing that bar, then what is the likelihood that the tax returns become public as a part of the grand jury process?
It seems like they won't become public for a very long time, at least not until the city decides to bring criminal charges either against the president after he's out of office or against some of his family members and entities. And that's because grand jury materials are supposed to be confidential. Now, during the oral argument, Justice Alito brought up the idea of there being some kind of leak to the public. But this is the Manhattan DA's office. It's a leak would be something that would ruin someone's career. So it seems unlikely that that's going to happen. Of course, it is a possibility, but probably the voters will not get a hold of the president's tax returns based on this decision before the 2020 election.
I can't think of a case either where members of a grand jury leaked something that they had considered as a part of a closed hearing. Grand juries are essentially professional juries, right? So that would be a highly unlikely place for a leak.
Right. These are individuals who are bound to secrecy. They sit for a long time. It's not just one trial that they sit for. They sit for an extended period of time. And the information is not just available to the grand jury, but also the DA's office. But again, this is a professional office that considers a lot of really high profile cases. And we haven't seen those kinds of leaks come out of the grand jury there.
We're talking with Bloomberg Law, U.S. Supreme Court reporter Kimberly Robinson. Kimberly, then there is the other sending back to lower courts on the House of Representatives subpoena of the president's tax returns. And is this in any way a precedent-setting case saying that a House committee cannot gain access to a president's tax records immediately?
Well, the majority, which was again 7-2, went out of its way to say that, you know, that's not what it's saying, that this is different from all the other cases that it's decided against President Clinton and President Nixon, to point out that here Congress is asking for documents from a sitting president. They're personal documents, and they're not on a criminal basis. Instead, Congress is asking for these documents to look at legislative reforms, to look at whether or not they need to shore up money laundering or terrorism or foreign involvement in elections. So that's something that the majority said, that this is unique to this particular situation and not like any that we've heard before.
All right. If you have questions about the decisions this morning from the U.S. Supreme Court regarding President Trump's tax returns, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. You can tweet at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. Another ruling that seems to be very big for the state of Oklahoma is about whether a significant part of the state is an American Indian reservation. What did the court find here, Kimberly?
Well, that is certainly going to be, there's going to be some fallout from this case. What the court was considering in this particular case was whether a federal law that says that Native Americans that commit offenses, crimes on, quote, Indian country must be prosecuted under the federal system and not under the state system. And in a 5-4 ruling, they said that a large part of Oklahoma fell under quote unquote Indian country for the purposes of the statute. Now, it leaves open a lot of questions about things like oil rights and taxes and civil cases. But at least for this case, the 5-4 majority really tried to limit it just to this particular federal criminal law.
Well, and this was a criminal case that I guess the justices determined should have been tried in a federal court, given that Tulsa and environs is part of this Indian reservation. But Kimberly, does that mean that anyone who's criminally charged in the city of Tulsa would now have to go through a federal court?
No. So under the federal law, it specifically applies only to Native Americans who commit these crimes on Indian reservations. So it would still allow Oklahoma to prosecute crimes against non-Native Americans, which is a large percentage of the Tulsa population.
But for those that are Native Americans, they would go through similar to a tribal process?
They would go through the federal courts.
Okay.
And one of the things that the dissent pointed out was that this could make thousands of Native Americans who are already charged and convicted of state crimes eligible for resentencing or a new trial or even release. So that was something that the minority was very concerned about with this case.
And you mentioned the potential for oil or other rights here, because if the determination is that about half of Oklahoma falls under this American Indian Reservation designation, then what does it go beyond criminal justice?
That's right. That's something that we just don't know the answer to. And so Justice Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion and crossed over to join his Democratic nominated colleagues, actually said, you know, there may be significant consequences to our ruling, but that's not a reason not to follow what the law says. And we saw him say something similar in the LGBT cases that came down earlier this term, which he also wrote, where he said, you know, these may have unintended consequences, but we have to follow the law as it's written. We can't just make it up.
All right. Bob in Downey said he wanted to know who the dissenting judges were, going back, I think, to the Trump tax return cases. Who were the two who dissented?
In both cases, it was Justices Clarence Thomas and Justices Samuel Alito, who, for very different reasons, would have sided with the Trump administration in both cases.
All right. 866-893-KPCC if you have questions about any of these cases that we're talking about on Air Talk. So we have the president's two nominees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, who, you know, part of the court here. You know, what's your sense of how this term of the court has been affected by Kavanaugh's joining?
Well, I think one thing that's really interesting to note is that last term, liberals, even though they hold a minority of the court, were able to pull out more wins in 5-4 decisions than conservatives, because every single conservative justice crossed over in at least one of those 5-4 cases, including Justice Samuel Alito, for the first time in over a decade on the court. This term, it was only Justices Roberts and Gorsuch. But I think some of that was mitigated today when the court was able to have a 7-2 ruling in both of these Trump cases. Importantly, both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, in their very contentious confirmation hearings, had pointed to previous rulings against Presidents Nixon and Clinton as a real championship for the rule of law, since the court was unanimous in those cases, even against by justices who had been nominated by that president.
Well, why do you think that the liberal wing of the court has been so much more consistent, so much more predictable as to what their decision, but that the conservatives, with the exception of Clarence Thomas, most of the time Justice Alito, that's been less true?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with their ideology. So I tend to think of Justices Thomas and Justice Alito a little more conservative, and Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh more libertarian. And so you see some just very small differences with them that can lead them in different directions. The four liberal justices really stick together on a lot of issues. We'll see them a lot of times not even writing separately, just joining majority opinions, even though it might not reflect their exact, their exact understanding of the case. It's really some squad goals, I think, for conservatives at this point, that the Democrats are sticking together so often.
And, of course, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, seemingly giving weight to his position as the Chief Justice and sort of his role of seeing the institution and precedent being so key. Is that, do you see it just an extension of the decision, for example, on the ACA and others where he joined with the liberals?
That's the thinking. Of course, you know, we can only speculate as to why Chief Justice Roberts is voting the way he did. But I think the abortion case that came down earlier this term is a really good example of how he takes into account the way that the Supreme Court is perceived and that it not be perceived as a political institution. You may recall that in that case, the court had considered a very similar abortion restriction a few years earlier, where the Chief Justice was in dissent. And this time around, he switched his vote, likely because he didn't want the outcome of a decision seemingly to turn only on the composition of the court.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if there are any cases that are expected to reach the high court dealing with policing. But I wonder, have we had anything to be able to glean sort of the attitudes of the justices toward policing, police protections, those sorts of issues that are, you know, to the fore in the public conversation now?
I would say, although not the first thing you think of when you think of policing, that the big deal in the Supreme Court has been this idea of qualified immunity, which has been used kind of as a shield to protect police officers whenever they violate constitutional rights. And at a 30,000-foot view, it sounds very reasonable. You want officers who violate your rights to not have done so innocently. But the way that it's been interpreted has really been a way to shield cops and provide no outcome for the victims of police brutality. And the Supreme Court has not been willing to revisit that, even though it had many opportunities this term to do so.
All right. David in Pasadena said, I want to clarify, Larry, federal grand juries are not professional. They're selected randomly from people throughout the district. Thank you. I just wanted to make a point that they're not like a single case and then they go. I loosely use that term, and I'm glad that you set that straight. Yeah, I didn't mean like that's their, you know, 10 years serving as a grand jury. But it is a little different than the typical jury that comes in. People are chosen for jury service. We're talking with Kimberly Robinson, U.S. Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg Law. She's also the co-host of the podcast that Bloomberg Law produces called Cases and Controversies. Kimberly, just before I let you go, are there any other high-profile decisions we expect this term?
That was it for today. The Supreme Court should have issued, while we were chatting, an orders list, which may include some grants. I don't know because I've been talking to you.
Okay.
But we're not expecting any more decisions. The court will start hearing arguments again in October, but it still remains to be seen if that will be in the courthouse or if the pandemic will force them remotely.
We'll look forward to talking with you soon before that happens. Kimberly, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. Kimberly Robinson of Bloomberg Law, U.S. Supreme Court reporter, talking about the decisions that were announced this morning. Coming up next, we'll talk about a brand new podcast from LAS Studios, California Love. We'll talk with the host of the podcast, Walter Thompson Hernandez, who joins us next. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute.